This is Brian Taylor, and this is the second in a series of seven talks for the course, The Empty Way, Zen Buddhism and Contemplative Christianity. Last week, we began with the basics and engaging in a discipline of regular meditation or contemplative prayer. And this week, we'll start getting into one of the themes of those two traditions, which is emptiness. It's probably the most central teaching in both Zen and contemplative Christianity, but it's also one of its most challenging ones. So we dive into the deep end right away. In Kennedy's book, Chapter 2, he writes about not knowing, the spiritual experience of emptiness, doubt, silence, and darkness. In the ox herding pictures, which this book is based around, the ox is unseen, or only seen in traces. Now, there are two ways in which the theme of emptiness appears in both Zen and contemplative Christianity, and these two ways are related. Emptiness as unknowing, and emptiness as insubstantiality, impermanence, and interdependence. I'll unpack both of those. First, emptiness as unknowing, or not knowing, as Kennedy calls it. This is letting go of certainty, sometimes called spiritual darkness, silence, and mystery. It's the kind of faith that is without guarantees or understanding, or even the comfort of experience. It's faith in a hidden God. Now, we experience this in many ways, of course, in life. In contemplative prayer or meditation, we experience it intentionally and directly in silence. Because without an object for our thoughts and our intention, in other words, if we're not meditating about something or praying about something, we have nothing to hold on to. We sit in God's presence, we wait, and we wait really without expecting anything to happen. But this experience also has a theological dimension. It's called the via negativa, or the apophatic path. Apophatic. Now, to understand this, we have to see it in relation to the via positiva, or the cataphatic path. So two paths, via negativa, or apophatic, and via positiva, the cataphatic. Now, cataphatic is what most people of faith experience and practice. It uses images, words, concepts, stories. It employs the senses, using icons, candles, crosses, stained glass. In prayer, it uses words. We meditate on a scripture passage, we may pray the Psalms, we pray about something going on in our life. It even includes the use of visions or seeking affective states, feelings, gaining insights. In worship, the cataphatic path uses music, things for the senses and the mind. In theology, this path uses doctrine, catechism, an explanation of how things are with God and with faith. The cataphatic is what most people by far assume that faith and prayer and church are all about. But every religious tradition has a minority experience and community as well. Christianity is no exception. There have always been a small number of people, often suspect, put on trial for heresy, misunderstood, who have been part of the apophatic path, or via negativa. It is sometimes called the contemplative. And the apophatic path is woven throughout Judeo-Christian history, right from Moses up through Jesus, Paul, the early theologians of the church, the Desert Fathers, medieval monks, people like Meister Eckhart, John of the Cross, Thomas Merton, all of those who are drawn to contemplative prayer throughout history and into our own day. In the apophatic way, God is mystery. Faith is an act of just trusting, without trusting that something in particular will result from either our prayer or our faith. Prayer is often silent, without an object. It's a kind of self-offering in trust, surrender, and the image of the cross is primary here. Worship is simple, spare, and so are places of prayer and worship. The spiritual path is one of self-emptying. The word kenosis has been used to describe this self-emptying. Rather than constructing a better self. This tradition is very ancient in every religion. In the Judeo-Christian religion, it begins with a foundational account of the Jewish faith when God first appears. It's in the book of Exodus, the story of Moses and the burning bush. Moses is told by the voice out of the bush, "Go set my people free, speak to the Pharaoh about this, etc." And Moses says, "Well, who shall I say sent me?" And the voice says, "I am that I am." Now, the acronym for this in the Hebrew word is, Hebrew words, is YHWH. There are no vowels. It is unpronounceable. It is a name that is not a name at all, but an expression of pure being, I am. This mysterious, unknown, unknowable, unnameable, I am, guided people into a mystery. 40 years of wandering in the desert, by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. The story is purely apophatic in nature. It is an unknown God, an unknown destiny, pure trust without any guarantee of an outcome. And this viewpoint, this experience continued through the century, through Judaism and Christianity. Here are a few examples. Many of the theologians of the early church who formed our doctrines, such as the Incarnation and the Trinity, were contemplatives. And really, our theology at that level doesn't explain anything. It expresses things instead. It expresses a mystery that's certainly true of the Trinity. It just states it without really explaining how that's possible. Now, one of these contemplative theologians was Gregory of Nyssa, one of the Cappadocian fathers, who said, "Concepts create idols. Only wonder comprehends anything. People kill one another over idols. Wonder makes us fall to our knees." A little later in the 5th or 6th century, there was a writer known as Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, one of my favorite names, who was very influential to all of the contemplatives that followed him. And he said this in his book, The Mystical Theology. What has actually to be said about the cause of everything is this. Since it is the cause of all beings, we should posit and ascribe to it all the affirmations we make in regard to beings, and, more appropriately, we should negate all these affirmations, since it surpasses all being. The fact is that the more we take flight upward, the more our words are confined to the ideas we are capable of forming. So that now, as we plunge into that darkness which is beyond intellect, we shall find ourselves not simply running short of words, but actually speechless and unknowing. One of the more influential books of the medieval time picked up on this theme. That's the book of The Cloud of Unknowing by an anonymous English author of the 14th century. And this, by the way, is the basis, really, for the popular form of contemplative prayer known as centering prayer that Thomas Keating and others have promoted over the last few decades. So the cloud repeats this theme from Pseudo-Dionysius as he teaches about faith. When I say darkness, I mean a lack of knowing, just as whatever you do not know or have forgotten is dark to you, because you do not see it in your spiritual eyes. For this reason, that which is between you and your God is termed not a cloud of the air, but a cloud of unknowing. Then later, the Spanish mystic John of the Cross wrote of the dark night of the soul. Now, this is often misunderstood and trivialized, as if this refers to any period of difficulty. I've heard people refer to going through some kind of a blue period as their dark night of the soul. John of the Cross is quite specific about it, however, and he's specific in a way that is exactly what the cloud refers to. The dark night of the soul is the experience of a loss of all understanding of God. It's a loss even of all experience of God. It is an emptiness that hollows out both meaning and consolation. In the same vein, Kennedy quotes from the 20th century Benedictine and Zen master, Villegas Yager. It is a decisive step when the individual in contemplation suddenly finds God vanishing out of sight or simply crumbling to pieces. This experience can at first give rise to great uncertainty. The Father's hand is withdrawn, and loneliness and a sense of lostness turn into a kind of abyss. Now, some see this experience of emptiness as a temporary desert, a diversion from the norm, a tough time to get through so that things can return to usual, or that one will eventually reach the promised land after the desert. For others, the desert becomes a new home, a new source of life. As the author of The Cloud said, "For myself, I prefer to be lost in this nowhere, wrestling with this blind nothingness, than to be like some great lord traveling everywhere and enjoying the world as if he owned it." In Zen Buddhism, emptiness in this sense is expressed in many ways. Certainly in meditation, in objectless, silent meditation, where one drops below thoughts, drops below intention, drops below any object that one might focus on. But also more generally, Zen Buddhism uses emptiness in its teachings, in the general sense that Zen is not explanatory. It remains mysterious, paradoxical. It's not linear. It is poetic, metaphoric, self-contradicting. Zen uses many stories that pull the rug out from underneath conventional understanding. And one of the most well-known is that saying, "If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him." Zen moves beyond concepts of who the Buddha is, or what Buddhism is, or what it means to be a Buddhist. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Or Zen uses koans, which are unanswerable questions that one ponders during meditation and other times. The most famous koan, perhaps, is, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" So in koan practice, one stays with these unanswerable questions in a non-conceptual way until something shifts in one's experience. Buddhism is often portrayed as atheistic, but really it is non-theistic. It avoids talking about God. It doesn't want to put this experience that people of faith call God into a box. And so, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. If you meet some concept of God on the road, and you think you've got God all neatly wrapped up in that concept, kill the concept. But Buddhism is non-theistic not because they deny whatever it is that we might call the divine mystery. It is to avoid idolatry. Because with idolatry, with putting this mystery into a box, we limit it, we deaden it. So Zen uses many different words, metaphors, paradoxes, images, to express this mystery. Emptiness is one of those words among many. When it is used, emptiness is sometimes described like a womb out of which all being arises. In this way, emptiness is seen as the flip side of suchness. Now, suchness is all that we can experience in the reality of any given moment. Light, sound, touch, thoughts, color, activity, people, all at once. The specific suchness of now. Suchness is manifest reality now. Now, in relation to suchness, emptiness is the ground out of which all suchness manifests. Emptiness is a kind of formless energy, the spiritually charged nature of everything that is. It is also sometimes called the absolute, or in Sanskrit, Dharmakaya, one of the three bodies of the Buddha in the Buddhist Trinity called the Trikaya. I'll talk more about this in another week ahead. Shunryu Suzuki uses the metaphor of a movie to talk about both suchness and emptiness. Suchness can be seen as the movie that is playing, the activity, the color, the stories, the drama, the characters. And emptiness can be seen as the blank screen onto which the movie is played. Now, we can be caught up our whole life in the movie, and usually are. But the Zen student or the contemplative is interested in the empty screen and asks, what is this? While most religions try to answer this question with theology and name what it is that that movie is playing on, Zen simply asks the question and then uses paradox, metaphor, stories, poetry to express things about it rather than trying to explain it. So now we enter into the second use of the term emptiness. Emptiness as insubstantiality, as impermanence, interdependence. This is the recognition that all of reality, physical matter, our thoughts, events of life, human history, and most disturbingly, what we call me, is insubstantial. Everything is fluid, ever-changing, impermanent. Everything is inseparable from everything else. Nothing exists as a separate unit. Now we see this in contemporary physics, especially at the subatomic level. Every material thing exists on a conventional level as separate objects. The table in front of me, me, you, the tree outside the window, they're all separate objects. But in reality, in an absolute sense, it is all swirling energy with more space, relatively speaking, between particles, or waves if you prefer, than the space between planets in our solar system. And none of it exists in isolation. The boundary between my skin and the air around me is an overlapping gray area. And everything that anything or anyone does has an effect on everything else. And so in physics, while we live in a conventional existence with real separate objects, in reality, there is no object that has substantiality or which is separate from anything else. Now, Buddhism figured this out a long time ago. It teaches that all phenomena arises interdependently. All phenomena evolves, influences other phenomena, is influenced by phenomena, and then passes away. And Buddhism calls this interdependent, changing reality emptiness. It is a description of how things are. This week, one of the optional readings is from Susan Kahn, a Buddhist psychotherapist in Los Angeles. She says this, she writes this, Buddhist emptiness is not the content of phenomena, or a universal essence or source. It is the recognition that the way phenomena appear to inherently exist is unfindable and thus illusory. So again, emptiness is an absence, not a thing. When the belief in inherent existence is refuted, the emptiness, the groundlessness of all phenomena is realized. Well, this teaching is especially challenging when applied to what we call the self. In terms of emptiness, you do not exist. You are not a permanent, separate thing. You are not a noun. You are a verb. You are, like all reality, insubstantial, impermanent, constantly changing, influenced and influencing as you evolve and eventually die. As Stephen Batchelor said, in Buddhism without beliefs, I am not a fixed essence, but an interactive cluster of processes. Now, in this teaching of emptiness, there are thoughts but no thinker, actions but no actor. And so instead of saying, I am upset, we could say more accurately, upset feelings are happening. Zen teaches us to disidentify with any sense of self. I think of Jesus' words, deny yourself, or St. Paul who said, it is no longer I who live. Now we all know people who are overly identified with something. They may see themselves entirely as the life of the party, a Chicago Cubs fan, a certain kind of Christian, or a Zen student. And when they do this, their life narrows the more they identify with this. Zen suggests the opposite, to disidentify with self, to disidentify with thoughts and feelings that arise, with circumstances that happen, with whatever personal drama we're going through, to disidentify from our personal narrative, in a sense, to disappear into the moment, so that we become the suchness, we become the whole thing, we become the task we're doing, the weather, the other person we're with, whatever's going on, all of it. Now, in the conventional sense, we live with a sense of me as subject, as I've said, to whom things happen, who manifests a personality. But in an absolute sense, there are only thoughts, feelings, actions, habitual ways of being. And Zen loves to live in both dimensions at once, the conventional and the absolute. And why is this helpful? Because when we have a fixed sense of self, we're rigid. When we think of ourselves as a thing, we have something to protect and we have something to gain. Believing that we are a subject also turns other things, other people, into objects. And objects, we can use them or ignore them, and they are a threat or are attractive to us. And this objectification leads to the two great sources of suffering that Buddhism warns about, aversion and attachment, two sides of the same coin. We avert ourselves away from things that we think will harm us or be unpleasant to this thing we call the self. And we are attached to things that we think will benefit or please this thing we call the self. And so we hate, we are greedy, we get addicted, we get defensive, all of the components of the human drama, and we cause ourselves and others immeasurable pain and suffering. This is foundational in Buddhism, this understanding, that this is the cause of suffering, aversion and attachment. So Buddhism teaches us to see ourselves as fundamentally empty, that is, a cluster of processes. And if we are a ever-changing cluster of processes, like everything else around us, we are bound together with all other beings. The whole show is moving, going on as one interconnected reality all the time. And so we can learn to be sensitive to one another out of this view, to everything. To treat the world, the environment, one another, even the enemy, as the self. Because it is. It is all the self. It is one big self. And this brings us to the Christian version of emptiness. It is, at its best, both the Jewish and Christian vision of the world, that it is one reality. It is all created by one energizing God who infuses everything with love and goodness. There is no other. It is all one. Jesus, in the priestly prayer of John 17, prays for his disciples that they all may be one. As you, Father, are in me, and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory you have given me, I have given them, so that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may be completely one. Then, of course, there's the sacrament of Eucharist, or communion, where we melt into Christ's body and into one another as one body in Christ. So to summarize, the emptiness we find in meditation and in faith and in life can be described in two ways that are very related. The first, as I said in the first section of this talk, is a willingness to surrender into the silence, into the mystery of unknowing, the cloud, and to trust. Not that something particular will happen, a peaceful feeling or an insight or whatever, but just to trust, no matter what our experience might be, to trust knowing that this emptiness is not a void. In either Christianity or Zen, it is charged with the energy of life. It has its own wisdom and goodness, and we can trust it. And this is a great lesson for life, because Much of life is beyond our control, beyond our understanding. Things happen. Nevertheless, we must walk forward in openness and in trust. Now, secondly, emptiness can be described in the way that I talked about in the second half of this talk, interbeing. In contemplative prayer, we are not alone. We are in communion with all the saints, with one another, with the air in the room, the light on the wall, the birds outside, with all those who suffer and all those who are lost. We can experience this in meditation if we open our hearts to its full reality. And this, too, is a great lesson for our life. For if we walk through the world this way, we can call upon the abundance of life around us and be more inclined to serve the greater good. So this week in your meditation, continue with the breath. Enjoy your breath. Enjoy your uprightness. Continue with the suchness of the moment in meditation. Everything around you, your sensory awareness, thoughts that come and go like clouds across an empty sky. Be aware of the beauty and ephemeral insubstantiality of it all. How fleeting, like mist. There's no boundary between inside and outside, between the self and everything else, between you and God. But rather, all of it is together as one constantly evolving organism.